Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that, and I must say it is a pleasure to me to have the opportunity to address this intellectual organization I have been a member of for a great many years. And I felt that as I came into the organization that I was clearly the least intellectual of all of its members. But I am a political activist, and I do have thoughts about our topic. Bearing in mind that unalloyed defense strategy, unalloyed defensive strategy leads to certain defeat in the long run, my question relating to our topic is, can the United States have a winning foreign policy? During the transition period between the 1980 election and the January 1981 inauguration of President Reagan, I worked in the personnel office of the president-elect. From all across the country, conservative friends asked me what could be done to clean out the rotten State Department. Despite any verdict of the voters, federal law protects members of the U.S. Foreign Service, so they can be fired if convicted of a felony. But merely an obvious loathing for the policies of the President of the United States is not a legally valid reason for dismissal. To these friends, I often replied in jest that we would simply have to swell the size of our U.S. embassy in Lagos, Nigeria. Lagos is notoriously the worst diplomatic posting of all. Quite often, nothing works in Lagos. Not the electricity, the telephone, the water, the sewage, or even the roads. Leftists in the State Department would find themselves facing the choice between resignation or long years in Lagos. But of course that didn't happen. In the spring of 1985, I was invited by students to speak in Connecticut at Choate, the exclusive preparatory school which nurtured John F. Kennedy. After my remarks and a lengthy question and answer period, an 18-year-old young man came down to speak with me. He was wearing a Jack Kemp for President button, and he said, "Gee, Mr. Blackwell, I agree with everything you said, particularly what you said about a winning foreign policy. My dad is in the Foreign Service, and he has told me all these things before." I replied, "Your father is in the Foreign Service, and he's a conservative?" "Yes," he said. "Where is he posted?" I asked. And the reply came, "Lagos, Nigeria." True story. Many faults of the State Department are notorious. A speaker before a U.S. conservative political gathering guarantees himself applause when he declaims on the manifold sins and wickedness of Foggy Bottom. Former Reagan National Security Advisor Richard V. Allen, a foe and a victim of the U.S. foreign policy establishment, said last year, half in fun and all in earnest, "I deny that there are no Reagan supporters in the State Department. I know a good half dozen of them." What's wrong with the U.S. foreign policy establishment? Here are two examples from my personal experience. In the spring of 1980, in a briefing at the U.S. Embassy in Guatemala City, an embassy staff member stressed to me that the U.S. must force Guatemala to break up all large farms and nationalize all banks in the export industry. I responded, "It sounds to me as if you are saying we must force Guatemala to adopt Marxism in order to save them from Marxism." The briefer replied haughtily, "I am describing the policy of the United States." Today, two conservative presidential landslides later, little has changed in the minds of many Foreign Service officers who staff our embassies. For instance, the economy of endangered El Salvador is crippled by so-called land reform and nationalization of the banks and the export industry. Until these steps are reversed, that country will remain an economic basket case. But the State Department does not push for reprivatization of the productive sectors of that economy. It is true that in 6 years, many Central and South American countries have passed from authoritarian to democratic governments. But the pattern is clear. The stronger the State Department influence in a country in transition to democracy, the more certain it is that the election will be won by the leftmost major candidate. El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala are cases in point. With respect to their ability to lead their countries to long-term political and economic freedom, the State Department's favorite new leaders in these countries look more like Kerensky than like Konrad Adenauer. And my second example. While on President Reagan's staff as project officer for the White House Outreach Working Group on Central America, I found the State Department and many career officers in other agencies always in opposition to most proposals for effective actions to generate public support for the President's anti-communist policies in Central America. The President's pollster, Dr. Richard Werfelin, conducted a nationwide survey for us to find the issues which would generate the most support for the President's Central American policy. One issue stood out sharply, and it was not democracy. And that's reasonable. Very few Americans would be willing to die or even to spend huge sums to ensure honest elections in Louisiana or in Chicago. Why should we expect public enthusiasm for sacrificing American treasure and perhaps American lives to guarantee honest elections in foreign countries? The Werfelin poll covered other issues, the Sandinista oppression of Catholics, Protestants, and Jews, the Sandinista covert aggression against Nicaragua's neighbors, the systematic destruction of the free enterprise system in Nicaragua, the possibility of Soviet nuclear missile bases in Central America, etc. The poll showed none of these issues of overriding concern to American voters. The one issue pollster Werfelin found most exciting to Americans was the likely arrival in the U.S. of additional millions of refugees from the region if communism takes more countries south of our border. That prospect proved to be of great concern for 82% of the national sample. Ah, I thought, here is how we can win the support the president needs. I had previously initiated a new concept called White House Digests. They were informational papers to be issued directly by the White House Outreach Working Group on Central America rather than, for obvious reasons, the State Department. So my office prepared a thoughtful paper about the real problems of homes, jobs, and social services to be faced by millions of refugees who would inevitably flee north if the Sandinistas' self-proclaimed revolution without borders spreads. Six of the seven U.S. departments and agencies participating in our White House Outreach Working Group approved our release, many of them enthusiastically urging the draft paper be printed and distributed. All except the State Department, which vetoed the draft, calling it xenophobic. So we revised the paper, pouring in quarts of the milk of human kindness, discussing the personal tragedies for refugees, abandoning their homes and enduring unspeakable deprivations and dangers as they would flee for haven in the United States. The State Department vetoed our draft number two. Still ethnocentric.
No, the other two are for...
We produced a third draft with the same effect.
No. Yeah.
After I left the White House staff in early 1984, the paper on refugees went through two additional new drafts. In all five drafts, the paper has not been published to this day. And the president still lacks sufficient support, even for the half measures now being proposed for contra aid. Any knowledgeable conservative observer could cite dozens of other instances of the State Department establishments weighing in against a winning foreign policy. Selective recruitment of liberals in the Foreign Service. Harassment of genuinely conservative political appointees in Foggy Bottom and in our foreign embassies. The co-option of nominally conservative political appointees. The resistance to U.S. aid to Jonas Savimbi's freedom fighters in Angola. The outrageous policy of aid to the communist regime in Mozambique, despite that government's maintenance of huge death camps and its hosting of thousands of Soviet Empire military forces. The constant emphasis on the pursuit of the so-called Contador process, which in fact is dominated by Mexico, whose foreign policy tracks closely with that of Castro's Cuba. Surely the U.S. State Department has been less affected by the 1980 and 1984 elections than any other important federal department or agency. The defiance by the permanent State Department of presidential election results is implemented in many ways. One of the least known and most effective is the selection of U.S. ambassadors to foreign countries. In theory, our ambassadors are the personal representatives of our president. In form, all ambassadors are appointed by the president. But it is well known that in practice there are two types of U.S. ambassadors, political appointees and career ambassadors. During the Reagan administration, two-thirds of all ambassadors are Foreign Service careerists. One-third are political appointees, men and women usually with close ties to the president and his philosophy. But let me here reveal a secret. Of course, the White House picks the political ambassadors, one-third. But hardly any American knows who picks the other two-thirds of the ambassadors, all of whom are Foreign Service careerists. The truth is that by an articulated, if not written, agreement, the White House allows the State Department to pick all of the career ambassadors who will then be nominated by the president. Politically appointed ambassadors, usually strongly conservative, tend to be sent where they can have little effect, either to major allies such as France or the Court of St. James, where Foggy Bottom always controls dozens of ongoing bilateral exchanges, or to small, placid countries such as the Bahamas or Luxembourg. But a country such as Chile, in which the East-West struggle is intense, tends to get career ambassadors such as their current ambassador, Herbert Barnes, and an equally leftist, equally competent deputy chief of mission, neither of whom ever took to heart Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick's work on dictatorships and double standards. Barnes and his deputy treat the anti-communist Chilean government more as Jimmy Carter treated Somoza's Nicaragua than as the United States treated Franco's Spain. And the results of Mr. Barnes' policy may one day be a Chile looking more like Sandinista Nicaragua than like democratic Spain today. To a high degree, U.S. foreign policy is controlled and conducted by an unelected, self-perpetuating liberal bureaucracy, militantly unresponsive to national election victories of conservatives. These entrenched bureaucrats act routinely as if it were possible to make friends of our enemies by making enemies of our friends. Is it any wonder this bureaucracy cannot develop a winning foreign policy? Decade by decade, the map grows more red as the UN foreign policy establishment keeps us desultorily on the defensive and allows the Soviets always to choose their best targets of opportunity. The Soviets, of course, are by doctrine always on the offensive. They trumpet the inevitability of their success through scientific socialism. Their so-called scientific socialism can be usefully defined as the empirical study of how to accumulate and keep power. What can we oppose to this systematic encroachment? Can the United States have a winning foreign policy? I believe so. But like the building of the current strength of our U.S. conservative movement, it will not be easy. Here, in the barest of outline, are some steps which should be taken toward that end. One, break the monopoly of the left on international cooperation at a private level and begin network building with freedom-minded people across the country. 10 years ago, we found at a meeting at the Dulles Marriott outside of Washington, D.C., that the leaders of the U.S. conservative movement, 75 of them assembled, knew not a single active ally in Canada. Reed Larson was at that meeting. And we are now clearly, obviously, making progress. Two, spread internationally ideas such as privatization, deregulation, and supply-side economics, which will lead to greater prosperity and more stable democratic governments, and focus on getting that information into those countries. Very few of the wonderful items that have been created by the conservatives movement in the United States have been translated and distributed to like-minded people in other countries. Number three, elect a U.S. president who will pick a Secretary of State prepared to play Samson, if necessary, to bring down the massive liberal infrastructure of our State Department. Recruit and prepare a large number of young conservatives for diplomatic service. Recognize that because public opinion does not automatically make public policy, issue education alone is not sufficient to win. Conservatives in all countries must learn and use effective political technology. 6. Persuade foreigners philosophically compatible with U.S. conservatives that political parties, while necessary, are not sufficient to turn the tide for freedom. Many other public policy institutions and organizations are needed. 7. Develop offensive strategies and focus on the enemy's weak points. Devote as much time and talent and money to destabilizing units of the Soviet Empire as they spend trying to destabilize non-communist governments. Achieve 2, 3 many grenades and thus break the image of irreversible constant communist conquest presented to the world in the form of the Brezhnev Doctrine. 9. Weaken further the political power of U.S. labor unions, the engine of socialism. Many union leaders voice anti-communism, but their domestic political power, their political muscle and resources, which are massive, are employed more than 90% of the time for anti-defense candidates. 10. Build a stronger, better organized U.S. political constituency for national defense and a winning foreign policy. We do not have time to discuss the role here of the Congress in foreign policy, but surely the world will be more safe and more free when we have, in the area of defense and foreign policy, specialized structures as well organized as the National Right to Work Committee, the National Rifle Association, and the U.S. pro-life organizations. 11. And finally, pray as if it all depended upon God and work as if it all depended upon us. Can the U.S. have a winning foreign policy? The Soviets know we can, and they are afraid of our capability. Consider this. Why are there virtually no Marxist terrorist bombings now in the United States? Why are U.S. anti-communist political leaders not assassinated routinely now in our streets, as is happening in so many other countries? Is it because the Soviets have scruples against such action? No. Is it because they lack explosives or lack willing agents or surrogates? No. Is it because we could catch all their agents or close our borders to infiltration? No. The reason, I believe, is this. A wave of Marxist-Leninist terrorism in the U.S. now would be counterproductive for the Soviets. And they know it. Before long, the question in our Congress would not be whether to aid the freedom fighter Contras, but how much help we could get to them and how quickly we could send it. Then our attention might be directed toward other Soviet Empire vulnerabilities, places like Mozambique, Angola, Guyana, Cuba, and so on. And even the State Department bureaucracy's best efforts might then fail to confuse us as to the best ways to advance the cause of freedom. She was talking way about her cottage.